Hello and welcome to Being Well According to Dan and Brian. I am the handsome half of this health and wellness podcast, Well AP, and accomplished human cave designer, Dan Shuffleton. I am joined, as always, with the Sultan of Salt Lake, the Colossus of Carpet, Brian Thompson. BT, how are you feeling today?
Feeling better now. Now that you said all that. I mean, I was feeling a lot smaller than the way you described me. So I'm top of the world, I guess.
Well, I actually pulled those titles straight off your business card. It actually says Brian Thompson, Sultan of Salt Lake, the Colossus of Carpet.
I love it.
I'm not sure if
I love it. Those were limited print, limited edition. So not everybody got one of those. So I'm glad that you found one on eBay.
I did. It is a collector's item. I paid a hefty price for it.
That's fantastic. I'm excited, man.
Yeah, me too. We have a powerhouse of a guest today. She has a background in healthcare design. She is a TED Med delegate. She's also a professor at Georgetown and comes equipped with not one, but two doctorates. Dr. Whitney Austin Gray, Senior Vice President at the International Well Building Institute. Hi, Whitney.
Hi, guys.
Thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Are you scared yet running away after that introduction?
Well, I love that I have two doctorates. My God, that's fantastic. I think I only have one that I'm knowledgeable about, but maybe we can say three or four as long as we're at it. But I'll try to do my best with the one.
I've got seven.
I figure, you know, overshooting it is better than undershooting it, right?
Yeah. You should have just owned it. We would have made it up. I mean, celebrities say they have doctorates that they don't have, right? I mean, they get them just at like being the valedictorian, or not valedictorian. What is it called when they come in to do the commencement speeches or whatever?
Emeritus.
Honorary doctorate.
Yeah, yes. Honorary doctorates. Yeah. All right.
Well, do the best I can with one today.
Okay. One is one more than I have. So I think it's going to be just fine. So Whitney, we want to talk about health and wellness today. That is the main subject of our podcast every week. And we see a lot of companies right now that are just unprepared for what's going on. And they haven't had the focus on health and wellness that maybe they should have, and maybe they're thinking they want to have. And you being with the International Well Building Institute, you have been incredibly active out there over the last couple of months. I bet you were Zoom called out, giving presentation after presentation about this subject. But what is some advice that you could give design professionals who are working on a project and wants to position the well-building standard with their client today in this environment that we're in?
Well, first off, thank you so much for having me. And thanks for all the work that you do to bring this really important topic to the forefront. So maybe I'll start with a quote. So Howie Frumkin said this years ago in publication of textbooks around the built environment and health, and Richard Jackson in saying that designers, architects, sustainability experts may have a greater impact on the future of the public's health than physicians. And I think no time like now, because what we're finding is that the built environment, of course, plays a critical role in protecting you from disease. But if not done right, it can actually promote the spread of disease. So the frontline workers who are out there every day translating what we know about public health into built environment solutions are so, so critical right now. Your voice really needs to be heard because this research can be confusing. So what are micron levels and aerosolization of the disease and cleaning practices and probiotic materials? And it's a really powerful time. And so I applaud that you bring this information education to your audiences that are every day translating on the front line. and really thinking about how they're preventing the spread of disease in so many different ways. And that's really critical right now. And it's not to say that we don't deeply need our doctors on the front lines. And there's a huge shout out for everything that medical professionals are doing, but it is to spotlight that we all are playing a role right now. And we don't need to wait in order to play that role to educate and empower our clients on how we can design healthy places to promote health and prevent disease.
That, and thank you. No, we really enjoyed this. And myself being a Well AP, and Dan is also a Well AP, you know, we're very passionate about the subject and, you know, and what we're doing. When you look at that, I think that's a great quote about how, you know, the impact that design has on us as humans. Where does a designer start? I think a lot of times, you know, when you have an end user who doesn't know about well, right, and they think about, you know, cost and, you know, and the impact of their business, and a designer is very passionate about it, and she wants to bring that to an end user, where is there a starting point? Is there a place to go find information that they can use to help position this movement and this idea that maybe would help them make it make sense for that end user who's having to write the check and having to spend the extra money?
So absolutely. I'm going to answer this question differently in the response to COVID-19 than I would a month ago. A month ago or 2 months ago, I should say, is that we were still out there talking about the business case of a healthy building. So why should you spend money on a healthy building? And I sort of look at it like the Snickers versus the granola bar. Like, if you want something that's discounted and easy and fast and you want a healthy building, it's not going to last over time. You need the nutrition, you need the investment, right? Health is not on the discount shelf. So these investments were really important, but hard to make when people said, oh, air quality, does it really matter? I mean, as long as it's okay in the building, it's fine. Why do I need to take things like VOCs into account, or particulate matter in my ventilation system, or cleaning practices for that matter? Why do I need to think about, you know, materials that would prevent the spread of disease? All of a sudden, that business case has changed a lot. My hope is that moving forward, instead of spending 40 to 50% of your time convincing your clients that pursuing healthy buildings and well building certification is an option, that you're going to spend maybe 1% of your time, and it won't be an option, it'll be required. And it'll be not just required for knowledge workers in commercial buildings, but it'll be required for factory workers, right? It'll be required in senior living. This will become the norm and not the exception. And in doing so, we really need to make sure that our designers are empowered with education and a path forward, because it can get overwhelming. So what is a well building?
Well, it's interesting you say that, because you think about the not just the people that work in an office building. And I think what hit me was, I mean, a lot of us are able to just work out of our house, right? Where the people that are, you know, working in the factories and working to supply everybody with what they need, they're not able to work out of their house and make those widgets or whatever they're making or shipping. And so you're right, it does go way beyond just the office environment.
Absolutely. And designers are one of the reasons I absolutely love working with designers. So my background, of course, is in public health and trying to translate the research into action. And the action is the designers on the front lines that are willing to work outside of the box, quite literally in the four walls of an office, and rethink about space in a new way. And when we are doing so in light of COVID-19 and other infectious diseases, I think we have a real opportunity to look at populations in need and think of innovative solutions, you know, around how they work, how they move, right? The spread of infection. I often talk about the beige on beige on beige scenario of the modern workplace, where we just had agreement reality. You just agreed to sit in a beige cubicle with beige carpet with a beige partition until one day someone told you you didn't have to. So workplaces will fundamentally shift inside of responding to this pandemic. People will not agree to the same beige on beige on beige. They'll want diversity in their environments. They'll want changes in their routines. And then when we look at those where the agreement reality is that factories were always going to be assembled this way with people standing exactly in this space at this time to produce the widgets, we have an incredible opportunity to pull in new materials, new ventilation systems, new technologies, new sensor technologies. And oftentimes, as horrible as it is that coming from public health, this isn't a time to back away from those really hard scenarios where we need to step up and in as design professionals, health experts, to find solutions for those vulnerable populations. Because in doing so, we actually can make an impact across the population. And let me just add another thought on there, which is something that I really have been researching a lot and it's kind of hold near and dear, is that this idea of universal design and inclusivity, and that often when you design for the extremes, you can benefit the means. So there's several people that are, you know, dealing with disabilities or vulnerabilities, they're immunocompromised, there's a new level of vulnerabilities out there. But if you really can design for some of these populations, is that you can actually benefit everyone. The classic examples that I would typically use would have to do with everything from, you know, curb cuts that allowed someone handicapped to be able to motorize, you know, their wheelchair, to people being able to pull a suitcase, right? But inside of COVID-19, you have us being able to look at vulnerable populations that need increased ventilation, increased cleaning protocol, technologies, potentially alternative materials that have more probiotic, you know, aspects of them. But when we can target these vulnerable populations, I think the lessons learned are going to benefit everyone. And probably now that I'm saying this out loud, the best example is healthcare, where we see an extreme population being treated, but we're going to start using the technologies from the healthcare environment. I think in, you know, commercial settings, in factory settings, definitely in senior living settings. So I think there's huge opportunity for designers, the front line, to be thinking about all populations, using this as an opportunity. And for the most vulnerable, I think we're going to see some great innovations coming out of new strategies from designers that can be applied for all different environments.
Whitney, I knew during this podcast I was going to be humbled. I didn't know that I'd be humbled this fast. That was phenomenal. I love the analogy between the Snicker bar and the granola bar. I've been trying to rack my brain for months about something that is you know, applicable to everybody that they would understand. And that was phenomenal. I'm blown away. And that was just one sentence. How about that? Or one thought.
Hope you like granola.
Actually, I do. I love granola. I have a question. I want to, you know, I find that when I'm trying to drive the ideas and well, and, you know, explain those and make other people interested and passionate about the ideas and features and well, there's some gap. So like, for example, air quality, right? How can my people in, you know, spaces who are designing other spaces, and how can the people in those built spaces be knowledgeable of, for example, indoor air quality in their building? You know, if they say, oh yeah, oh, the air quality here is great, but you know, that's not something that the average person can measure. How can we just kind of, as humans, get a better hold on that?
Sure. So air quality is a very pertinent topic right now. If you take a deep breath, do you know that the air around you is healthy, and how do you know that? So where I actually like to start is going back to sort of evolutionary biology. So you can detect certain things in the air quality and others you can't. The things that you can detect, you'll have an immediate response. So we call that a proximal response. So for example, if you have high formaldehyde, if you have high VOC levels, you may get a headache. Sick building syndrome is predicated on these direct exposures that create itchy eyes, itchy skin, and you have an immediate response. And if you have that response, don't wait around for it to get worse. This is a biofeedback loop that has been given to you to get out of harmful scenarios. What's interesting is what we can't detect. COVID-19 as a virus, to give you an idea, 700 to 1,000 viral particles can live in the diameter of a human hair. Wow. We can't detect that. So we need gatekeepers. Those gatekeepers are ones that will tell you, using oftentimes data, about the information in the building so that you can trust that the building is healthy. I call that making the invisible visible. So those gatekeepers are your clients. They're going to invest in a well building that's going to be looking at ventilation issues, number one. So we're going to be looking at airflow. People have no concept just how much air is recirculated. We're going to be looking at the humidity levels. So we know certain viruses do and don't like dry air, right? Because of the way they can spread. So we're going to look at that factor. We're going to look at issues potentially pulling in technologies from healthcare. So ultraviolet germicidal irradiation. This is your UVC technology. So we're going to say that we've actually filtered the air potentially. That's also going to help you with mold control. That's also going to help you if your building has been sitting for a prolonged period of time. Buildings are not meant to be turned off. So that's also going to be a thing now that we're monitoring the sort of return to work scenarios. So air is complex. So what you can detect versus what you can't detect. And then I think making it clear to clients that you're investing in the designer, right, or your consultant in that situation to be able to provide you information on what you can't detect as the gatekeeper so that you're assuring your air quality to the highest level. Now, air quality alone is not going to address COVID-19. It's part of a bigger picture, but I can't emphasize enough is that making the invisible visible for your clients is very powerful. And putting a dollar amount on that, and I think that's changed in ways that people did not appreciate what good air quality was previously. And buildings do a lot of breathing for us in parts of the world. And I think we'll be also seeing, and I hope even clusters of office parks and those that find in their own way a resiliency because all of those buildings have taken precautionary steps to certify their building, to test and to communicate what they're doing to occupants when they return. And as a occupant in the building, you're more likely to trust your owner, your building manager, your employer, when they're communicating to you what you can't see so that you can make a decision about your own health.
You know, I've heard the term being used proof case, which is what, from what I understand, it's about performance testing and transparency. Is that kind of what you're describing here?
Yes. So I think many of us have been to a conference where someone says, I'm the healthiest building ever. In fact, it happened often with green buildings in the early days where you find cases that the designers and architects and those in the manufacturing sector that were speccing out the products did everything they could do to make that building healthy according to those requirements. But then once the building was built, people moved in. I call them messy variables. They do things that you don't plan them to do. And all of a sudden you come back a year later and the building is not healthy. It's even potentially off-gassing, or they brought in formaldehyde-laden artwork or bad behaviors in smoking. These things are difficult to track, but unless someone's coming in a year later and testing and tracking whether or not your building's performing, you don't know if it's really healthy long-term. And so that's where investing in health is critical. Health isn't, you know, like I said, you can't find it on the discount shelf. So if you're just saying it's a healthy building without actually demonstrating the proof case, then I think that's not really a healthy building. And, you know, it's like a doctor saying that they went through medical school but never took their board exams. And you'd say, well, I'm glad that you went to class. Don't know how many you skipped. But until you can show me that you've gone through your board exams, I don't really want you operating on me. So if a building can't prove that it's healthy over time, it's kind of likened to saying, yeah, you said you did some stuff, but I don't actually know if you tested that to the point that I can validate it and trust those outcomes.
Which, by the way, is one reason why I love the WELL building standard, is because
here.
It's not a once and done. And it's also not just taking your word for it, right? I mean, you have to have somebody come out and 70% of it's field verification. And then, you know, every 3 years, you got to go get re-verified and make sure you're still doing what you're doing. And beyond that, most of the concepts and features, you know, include ongoing testing and at least, you know, once a year, a lot of them require you to submit that for verification as well. So I love that.
Yeah, maybe I'll add there is that I don't think I've ever met a architect, an engineer, a designer, someone coming from industry manufacturing saying, wow, I can't wait to produce and design and build an unhealthy building.
Right.
You know? So no one's saying that, but it is interesting the way that contracts are set up, that once a building is designed, that certain, you know, building professionals don't feel like there's space for them to come back in a year later. I think there's some tremendous professionals that do that and create great relationships with clients. But oftentimes there's not a mechanism in the contract that says, let me come back a year later and see how we did. We are tracking buildings such as the American Society of Interior Designers, which was the first WELL Platinum building in the world. And we're finding that after 1,000 days of being open, the building can be even healthier than day one, because they're testing and tracking and the data's coming back. And every year they have to submit, you know, limited paperwork to WELL, but they also have to recertify every 3 years. And some people say that's a burden. For them, that's actually the data's helped them to evolve and to be able to say, my building can actually be healthier day 500 or day 1,000 than day one. And so this idea that buildings evolve, and if you have data from these messy variables, AKA people, that move in, you could actually sell a project being healthier a year from now if you're given access to talk to the client. And WELL does give you that access, because through the requirement of submitting paperwork and recertifying, it gives our design professionals a front line to be able to talk to the client and say, how are we doing a year later? What do we need to do to adjust? How are people using the space? And I think that I guess my hope is that our community feels empowered than to guide clients to really be able to design and elevate their projects to be healthier, not just day one, right? But over time.
Meaning, it's funny you say that, because just yesterday I got a question. I did a WELL 101 CEU, and I had a question from a designer. And the question was, once we design and certify a WELL space, who's responsible for making sure that they continue to do what they're supposed to do? It was a really interesting thought, and, you know, I kind of had no the answer, but I mean, from your perspective, I mean, how do you start that conversation going from, okay, you've got their buy-in, and you, like you said, they don't write that into the contract, but how does that process look to you in an ideal world, moving forward between a design firm and an end user?
Sure. I mean, a WELL building is a team sport. So you can design it, but it also needs to be operated and maintained as a WELL building. So we're not going to solve this alone in design. We play a critical role, but we also need to activate that design. So WELL does focus on building design, operation, and policy. But I think some of the best projects are going to have that WELL champion internal to the team. Oftentimes, someone who really cares a lot about their health, they may have gone through a lot. I mean, we hear these stories of people anecdotally like losing 30 pounds, they moved into a WELL space, or that their, you know, daughter or son was dealing with asthma and now they have a better understanding of this, or they have a colleague that doesn't report out sick, you know, from respiratory issues. These are really personal things. So I love it when we see a WELL advocate or champion step up from the organization. We in the WELL standard encourage you to designate that individual or team. And I would even go as far as saying, consider in your operational budget how to give them a little bit of space so that they can do lunch and learns, you know, do follow-up surveying where they can activate the findings and host events for people. These are all opportunities. And I think we also see this emergence of the chief wellness officer. And this will be interesting. If you flash back, I guess, to about 15, 20 years ago with the LEED certification, you really saw this emphasis on energy performance and building monitoring systems to a professional in the facilities that was not always trained to be able to operate some of these systems, that may have felt overwhelmed, that didn't have direct access to the C-suite. I think groups like facility, you know, institutes and our partners working with facilities guidelines have really elevated and now accredited professionals to be able to be educated, informed, and empowered about how to use energy systems and building monitoring systems. And they report directly to the C-suite now. That is a big change in 20 years. So to operate a WELL building, we need partners to activate the design and operation. Those partners, I think, are going to be coming from more so HR. And if you look at the history of HR, Well, you see people that may not feel like they have the education or background or feel empowered to talk to the C-suite. You know, these are people maybe coming directly out of school that are more in the disability and benefit conversation. So we're seeing some nice, real movement forward to see these professionals like a chief wellness officer step into the role, be acknowledged by the C-suite, and be empowered to make the change. So I would say we need to be tracking those with companies. We need to be elevating the well champion. And that champion needs to, you know, have direct access to the C-suite. And I'll just kind of close my comment there that there is an interesting research study done a couple of years ago by the Integrated Benefits Institute. And they asked chief financial officers in the next 3 to 5 years, how many of you anticipate spending more on health and well-being? And this was done around 2016, I think. So, and it was fascinating that it was like 99% of them said, oh yes, we will be spending more on health and well-being, right? So in some way, we'll be spending more. And then later on in the survey, they were asked how many of them will ever test the ROI behind that investment. And 6% reported they had any plans set up to do so. So the people making decisions about the investment in health of your people may be different than who you think it is. They may not have the tools and strategies to do so. So to really make sure that your investment in a healthy, well building coming from the real estate facilities team is making its way over to the HR and the CFO is critical and will require industry to rethink about those individuals, empower those individuals, and of course be able to track and validate back to that proof case on not just the cost per square foot, but the cost per person that we're investing in a well building.
I love that. A couple of things that jumped out at me was the idea of involving HR. I think that's crucial. And you're right. I mean, you don't see a VP of HR hardly anymore. It's always VP of people or things like that. It's that people element to it. And you know, and to clarify, when you're talking about a champion, a wellness champion, we're really talking about somebody at the organization, not necessarily the design firm, but at the organization. And sometimes you've got these smaller companies that don't necessarily have that person. They may wear multiple hats. But would that be a conversation that would also be kind of guided by a well coach that they're assigned when they register the project? Because I know a lot of people, they look at this and they feel really intimidated. But that well coach, if I'm thinking correctly, is really a huge resource to them to help them guide them through that process and that ideology. Is that accurate?
Oh, absolutely. And I think
they're not in it alone, I guess is the point, right?
And that relationship then becomes two ways. So if you are a well AP and you're advising your client and they have their own well champion, whatever name they want to call it, instead of you telling them about the well building, they're telling you as a person experiencing it, what's happening. And that becomes a two-way conversation, which then allows you to evolve the building to continue being healthy versus saying, oh, we're done. This building's healthy. Gotta go. So that's super empowering, I think, to have a two-way conversation. The other thing that I would just highlight is that I believe deeply in this as a professor and working in this space. Adjunct is that I've never met a design professional who's told me they were required to take a class in health. And I've never, for my own field in public health, ever met someone that within their requirements was required to take a course on design. So, you know, don't feel overwhelmed if you're at an organization where all of a sudden they're asking you to raise your hand to be an advocate to talk about health when your background is coming in from design or vice versa. You know, we're in this together. And that's really why we set up the Well AP program. So if folks are interested, we actually have a lot of free training right now that we have put forward during COVID-19 and our response so that you can learn about this. You can download the Well Building Certification for free. I'm really proud that both those resources are completely free right now. And we've also discounted if you want to pursue the Well AP program by 60%. And we're giving 20% of those proceeds to Doctors Without Borders. So that's our way of saying that we need you to be the voices in the front lines. We need you to raise your hand. Even if you feel like your training and background isn't in this, this is our time. We are in one of the largest experiments ever when it comes to reshaping how we're going to work in the future based on this. And if you feel like this is a good time while you're maybe at home to pick up a book and learn a little bit about this, you can do so just by downloading the standard or by taking a class for free. And if you want to elevate that and be recognized, the WELL AP test is available now too, which is really discounted. And I will just add a final note that we discounted even further if you're a student or if you're out of work right now, with this real commitment that I think the more we educate people, the stronger the voices are, the better advocates they can be as they return to work. And I think as design professionals, then we can work better those advocates and have those powerful two-way conversations around how a building can evolve and continue to be healthy over time.
Well, as someone who sees a tremendous value in health, wellness, and the standard, thank you for that. Just you know, helping everybody get educated and, you know, giving them access to it, especially, you know, if they're at home or if they have limited financial means right now, I think that's awesome. I have one question before we start to wrap up. And I have my own opinion on this, obviously, but I want to ask you, Whitney. I want to talk about material transparency. Now, I understand why we have it, but I want your opinion. Do you see it being a huge factor in selecting products, or is it just like the current buzzword? Do you see designers out there like, oh yeah, you know, material transparency is important, but I like the look of this chair. So, you know, I don't care about its label or what it's claiming or it's, you know?
So yes, material transparency is important. This is like, if someone gave you a Twinkie and said, don't worry about what it is, what's in it, it's fine. You want to know what's in your products and it matters to your health. And if people get away with putting anything they want in the product without any transparency, then we find ourselves going back in time. So the more companies are putting forward transparency, the more they're asking their consumers to trust them. Like, here's my practices. Here's what I'm doing. Trust what's in my materials. And that goes above and beyond the actual conversation of what's in the material into a conversation around trust. And that is going to be so pivotal right now as people are returning to workplaces going, you know, how can I trust this space is healthy? If I can't see it, then how can I trust that? I also think from the world of material transparency, there's some incredible movement in what we're doing with microbiome and understanding the power of materials for colonization, bacterial growth and spread, you know, durability of products that we're learning from healthcare that are now being translated to different environments. I think we're going to see an incredible power in these, you know, fabrics and materials that we sit on, that we drive in, that we, you know, have a chair or office space that's built out of them. People are going to start asking harder questions because they never, at least most people in this generation, have no institutional memory of infectious disease. That's something from their grandparents' generation. And this is going back to polio.
Yeah.
So now they're going to start thinking a lot differently about surfaces, about materials, about what's in it, where did it come from, and can I trust people? So of course, I deeply support what's at the fundamental root of that, which is not how fast can I tell you what's in my product, but how committed am I to transparency for overall health for my client? And I will add that coming from public health is that the WELL Building Standard focuses on the overall exposure of the occupant to what's in their built environment. So solving what happens in one chair is not going to solve the exposure overall to the client. So I think if I can add anything is that in the end game, it really is about the entire environment and the exposure to the individual. So material transparency, my hope is that we really think through the multiple components of materials that are in environments and how they're also interacting and not hyper-focus on one product alone.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's phenomenal insight because I think so many people would probably think, oh, well, you know, we have this factor and that should take care of this, and they don't look at their whole space in general. Excellent. Thank you. I appreciate that. It's now time. I hope you're excited. I hope you're a little bit nervous because you should be.
Uh-oh.
For the Fast Five. Whitney, I have some questions for you. These are fun, off-the-cuff questions. and just, you know, answer them as the first thing that comes to mind. Are you ready?
Yeah, go for it.
Question.
No one's ever ready, Whitney.
No one's ready. Ever ready. No, you don't know what's going to happen. It's crazy. Question number one, coffee or tea?
Coffee.
Question number two, what's your favorite candy?
I don't really like candy.
You don't really like candy? I don't believe, really? How about, like, nothing?
Like chocolate?
Chocolate, okay. Chocolate, I'll take that. That works for me.
You knew that was going to happen. You're talking about health here.
Yeah, indeed, indeed.
Well, everyone has a guilty pleasure.
Yeah, it's a judgment-free space.
I have research to support the antioxidants in chocolate.
So. Wonderful. Excellent. Whitney's answer is dark chocolate. Excellent. Perfect. High cocoa, high percentage cocoa. What did you do on your first date with your husband?
We went to brunch. We went to brunch, but I'm really glad you're asking me this because it happened exactly 3 years ago today.
Oh, really? Oh, that's phenomenal. Yeah. How about that?
A healthy brunch, I'm sure.
We do our research, you know, we knew that already. So that's why we asked the question.
Yeah, he clued us in. So that's extra bonus points for him. How about that? Question number four, beach or mountains?
Beach.
Question number five, what's the one place you want to visit?
That is a trick question right now.
do explain.
I'm like, my office environment, that would be great to visit my office right now. let's see. I'm a total wanderlusted soul. So my goal was to get to 100 countries by 50. So I've got a couple of years going, but I think I'm around 85 or so.
Are you really? Wow, that's impressive.
Yeah, I just can't get enough of that. And it's sort of the world's become smaller and weird, you know, in this time. And also it's felt like so distant to get to some of these places that we really want to. So maybe I'll just put out there the Galapagos Islands. I think that this is a place that's going to fundamentally shift. And it's really thinking a lot about what's happening down in South America right now. And, you know, what's happening in the world around sustainability and health and pollution and animal species and all that great stuff wrapped into one. So I do hope someday to be able to hang out with those, you know, big turtles and learn more about those ecosystems and have the world open up its borders a bit more so we can again travel.
And we actually have a bonus question today because this is a bit of information that I just found out recently. You are about to have a baby in about a week.
Yeah.
It's your due date. So really it's any day now.
That's right.
The bonus question for the Fast Five, question number 5.2, 5.B, I don't know, 6, who knows? Are you having a boy or a girl?
Hi, we've got this one. So we are having and we're welcoming a little baby boy.
Well, absolutely.
What's his name?
Hunter is his name.
Hunter, very yeah. Nice.
Yeah.
You like that. I was hoping it'd be Dan, but you know what?
Next it's not one, too late. I can suggest it, yeah.
Yeah, slide that into the last minute.
I mean, Hunter's really close to Brian. I mean, it's almost the same thing. It's just spelled a little differently. It's got okay, a lot of this.
Hunter, Brian, Dan. All right. Got it.
I like
I'll
it.
Yeah, yeah. My husband.
Yeah.
Well, Whitney, thank you so much for joining us on our podcast. We certainly appreciate your time and expertise. I can speak for Brian on this one. Brian and I are very humbled and appreciative of you and what you're doing to better the human race and our built environment.
Amen. Yeah.
Well, thank you both. Be well.
Indeed. Folks, if you enjoyed our podcast, hit that share button, tell your coworkers, buy a billboard to promote this health and wellness podcast. However you feel you can best contribute to society and the education of health and wellness. I'm Dan Shuffleton.
I'm Brian Thompson.
And this is Being Well, according to Dan and Brian.